Welcome to the Don't You Worry podcast. We're your hosts, Briley and Britton Caldwell, and we're here to say don't you worry through stories, encouragement, and joy. Be sure to like and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. So sit back, relax, and enjoy today's conversation. Hey guys, we are interrupting our Fighting Words series today because we have a story that we could not wait to share with you. We hope you enjoy the episode. Hey guys, welcome back to the Don't You Worry podcast. I'm your host, Briley Caldwell, and Britton's not with us today because she was busy, but I'm so excited because I've got Kyle and Leah Runyon on the podcast. And Kyle has led worship with me before. He's like the greatest Cajon player I think I've ever met. And I love Leah, and you guys have an incredible story. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to get to talk to you all today.
Yeah, we're excited to be here.
Yeah. So I wanted to start off asking you something fun. So you guys are really big into traveling. Mm-hmm. You guys have probably traveled so much more than I have in my entire life. So what has been like your favorite place that you've ever gone?
Oh man, that's tough. You go first.
I think Barcelona, probably.
Yeah.
It was just such a cool atmosphere, and you get the mountains, and you get the beach, and you get the city feel. So it's kind of like the best of all the worlds all in one. So it was really neat.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's weird. I almost have like a favorite trip and a favorite place.
Yeah.
And it's also odd because our trips have been so big. But I think, like she said, Barcelona was probably one of my favorite just specific places to be. It was just really cool. But then my favorite trip was back in October. We went to Colorado, and we went to Red Rocks and went to the Rocky Mountain National Park. And I had been to Denver several times, but that trip alone, and a lot of it was we'll talk about a little bit more. We had our baby with us. That was his first trip.
Yes.
And that just made traveling so much different, such an experience that was just different from everything I'd done before. So that one's definitely probably my favorite trip.
Yeah.
But Barcelona is just beautiful.
That's so fun. I would love to go there. Yeah.
Just gonna take him to Barcelona.
Absolutely. So you guys have an incredible story, which is why I wanted you on the podcast today. So I'm just going to let you kind of take over, and then I'll kind of ask questions along the way. But if you want to go ahead and kind of intro, talk about your story.
I'm very emotional, so I'm probably going to cry many a time through this, so I'll let him do most of the talking, but I definitely have a few things that I'd like to add. But
you don't want to start with anything? You just want me?
Nope.
Okay. So I guess the reason we're here is we had a son 7 months ago now. Almost. And the story of his coming into the world was a very emotional, traumatic, and just one of those stories that you point out and say God had his hands in everything. And so I guess we'll just start with it.
I think one important thing that I will add is that we had started the Experiencing God Bible study with a few friends from our small group. And so at that time, one of our friends had just had a baby. There was another due in the middle of the study, and then I was due at the end of the study. And so we were all kind of like, you guys are insane. This is not the right time. We're going to have three newborn babies around. But everything that I've seen now that I've went back and looked at it, just what God was preparing us for by having us go through Experiencing God is wild.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure she'll have a lot to say about little tidbits of that. But to begin, we knew that we could have issues with pregnancy and everything. She has a rare genetic. And they had told us that we would have difficulty getting pregnant and having kids, and good chance of miscarriages along the way. And her mom had a couple, and we knew this was a possibility. And so going into the pregnancy, everything was great. We had about halfway through, had done some tests to see if he would carry the same gene as her or if would have a mutation which would cause a miscarriage. And he came out, all of his genetics look good. He does carry the gene, but that's not an issue. But they had told us going into it that it was basically a 50% chance that we would miscarriage.
Yeah.
So it's flip a coin whether you'll even have the baby. And so the fact that, and so also going through this, we're talking with Experiencing God, and it's like we're experiencing him work through already defying statistics and defying odds of our first pregnancy ever is mm-hmm. healthy. Everything came through. He's looking great. All the scans. And then we get to labor. And nothing out of unusual happened during labor. His heart rate was dipping a little bit, but they had said that was pretty common with mm-hmm. contractions because yeah. he's in stress. But then as they were trying to put in an epidural, or just from my standpoint, I know hers was a little bit different. She was the one getting all that done to her. But we're sitting there, and all of a sudden, the heart rate dropped, and it was like 100 people. I think it was like 7, but it felt like the whole room just got crowded with people, and they're flipping her over and doing different things. Like, we have to get this heart rate up.
Yeah.
And then, so it finally came to, and everything was fine. And then that's when they started asking us, his heart rate seems to be getting affected more by stronger contractions. And so would we rather just go ahead and prepare for a C-section and not stress him out through the whole laboring? So we had decided to do that. And they had planned it for like an hour, hour and a half later. And then about 10, 15 minutes after that, his heart rate had dipped again. And they come rushing in. They're like, well, we're not waiting an hour. We're going right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of turned from a, well, this would be a better option for your baby, but it's totally up to you, to, hey, we've got to get in the operating room ASAP.
And so as we're in there, I can remember they were like, yeah, we're going to wheel her in while you get all the gown and stuff on, and then we'll come get you. It'll be like 1 or 2 minutes, and then we'll go in there, and it'll be a pretty quick process. And I felt like I was in that room waiting for 20 minutes, but it was literally like 3. And then I walk in there, and it's like instantly, they're like, oh, there he is. But we never heard him cry. We knew that something was going on. And they had told us to expect a little issues with his breathing because they had found, what is it?
Meconium, which is like the thick first baby poop. And so when they broke my water, they found meconium. And so they were like, you know, no big deal. The NICU team will be there. This is a very common thing. He may have some trouble breathing, but that's mm-hmm. why they're there. So it's nothing to worry about. And so we're in the operating room, obviously not how I had planned for everything to go anyway. So that's like the first step of God's like, well, you had a plan, but here we go. And so I felt like it was an eternity, like hours had went by and we're laying there and I had not heard him cry. And so I'm like yelling at my nurse. I'm like, Jamie, please tell me what's going on. And she's like, they're working on him. And that's all she said. And I was like, okay.
And then so they kept working on him and they were like, well, he's not breathing on his own. He's not responding, but we're working. And so then they went to wheel him out. They had put him in a little, almost like a fish tank. It's kind of what it looked like. But obviously it was for the babies, and they went to wheel him out. And so we got to see him basically as he's getting wheeled out of the room. And so they said, look, we're taking him back to the NICU to keep working on him. He was breathing at that point, but they had went ahead and put a vent in the operating room. So they knew he was having trouble, but his heart rate looked okay and he was getting air. And so they took us back to the recovery room. And then that's when it all started going crazy. So we're sitting in the recovery room just recovering. And the doctor walked in. The first thing he said to us was, we're going to have a hard conversation. And at that point, he told us that at some point during the pregnancy or labor, at some point, Ollie had lost oxygen. And it was enough to cause damage to organs and to his brain. And there was this thing called HIE, it's some long medical.
He walks in as he's talking to us and he says, it's this thing called HIE. Don't Google it. And so you're like,
he was like, if you Google it, you're going to get horror stories. You don't need that right now.
Yeah.
And so that just eye opener, you're like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. And he basically said, look, we're doing all we can, but it's not a good outlook. Mm-hmm. If he recovers, you're probably going to have some severe damage.
And I don't know how long we had been in the recovery room, but like not long that he had come in, and obviously not too long after Ollie had been born, and your dad shows up in the recovery room and it's like no visitors, no nothing, no guests, no, and we had a nurse come in and she's like, hey, there's a pastor here, and he pops in. And I'm like, how did you even get back here?
We hadn't even told anybody that we were having the baby.
Yeah.
But we had told him that we had got admitted to the labor and delivery, but nobody knew at that point anything. And he just showed up.
That's crazy.
And there was a nurse there that
had he was connected
been,
to.
Yeah, your dad had been her youth pastor or something. Yeah. So like already an hour and a half in, it's like, what? Okay, God, what are you doing?
Well, because we were at home and we were doing like something low-key chill that night. But then he was like, hey, I think Kyle and Leah are having their baby. I'm going to go to the hospital. But that, like, but it wasn't like a weird thing because we were like, oh, he does this to people all the time. But we had like no clue what was going on.
Either. Yeah, I think the doctor had just walked in and told us the news of, and he had said, it doesn't look good. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back and check on him.
Yeah.
And then I had asked our nurse, I was like, our whole family is sitting out in the waiting mm-hmm. room. We've got to tell them. And I don't know how to tell them this. Mm-hmm. So I was like, do you think the doctor would come out and tell him? And she's like, yeah, well, let me go find him. And at that point, that's when your dad walks in.
Yeah.
And then while we're sitting there talking to your dad, the doctor comes back in and he says, hey, I will come talk to your family, but it's going to have to wait. I need you to sign these papers right now. We need to do an emergency blood transfusion. Your baby doesn't have blood in his body.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
I can't even wrap my mind around that.
Yeah. No. And really neither could they, which was kind of a strange place to be in a room with a bunch of doctors and nurses. And they're like, we don't know what's going on. And you're like, okay.
Yeah.
He said, typically there'll be a rupture or you'll see bleeding in the mom. But mm-hmm. she said, nothing was unusual. I don't know where the blood went, but we've got to get him some.
That's crazy. Because like during labor and during pregnancy, like he had blood, right?
Yeah. I mean, like as far as we knew, everything was good. I had a wonderful pregnancy. I mean, labor was labor, but like it wasn't crazy.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And they to this day still don't know where it went.
That's wild.
But then he had said that we got to do these transfusions. And so with the HIE, they have to put the baby on a cooling pad, mm-hmm. which is, it's kind of strange, but basically it said that when the brain damage is occurring, they can cool the baby's body down to like a hypothermic temperature and it'll stop the damage. Like if any damage is going on right then. And then, so he had to be on a cooling pad for 72 hours. But then the doctor said, but with this blood issue and him not breathing, if we have to warm him back up to solve another issue, that's more damage that could occur and all this. Mm-hmm. And so, and the doctor said, look, I'm going to be very blunt with you. It's grim. There's not very good possibilities that we're going to come out of this.
Yeah.
And so okay. I said, I signed papers, do what you need to do, doctor. And so then we're just still trying to figure out all this, what's going on. It's like, you just been hit with a water hose mm-hmm. right after or something that's already going to be traumatic, just birth in general, even if you have a healthy baby. Mm-hmm. And so then I asked, I was like, can we go back and see him? And they said, yes, they wanted to get Leah back to her room and get everything calmed down there. And then we would go. But on the way there, the doctor said, well, while the nurse is wheeling her back to her room, he took me back by, he said, I couldn't touch him or do anything right then, but I could just see him mm-hmm. to see kind of what was going on. So I was walking back to the NICU with the doctor and after he had talked to our family and stuff. And I can just remember we walked those halls for, I couldn't tell you how many times for the next month, but that walk, I felt like we walked to the other side of the hospital mm-hmm. and it was literally just one wing over and down the hallway. And I can remember just every step I took on that walk. And the one thing that stuck with me, the doctor said, he said, look, I'm blunt. I'm not going to sugarcoat anything. I'm going to tell you how it is. And I said, I appreciate that. I want to know. I don't want you to sugarcoat it and tell me everything's going to be okay and it's not. He said, I'm going to do everything I can. He said, but there's only so much we can do. And at this point, the only thing we can do is put it in God's hands. So he said, if you're praying people, I'd suggest praying. I said, well, you don't know who you just said that to.
Yeah.
And that was our MO from the start was, we get these bad news. Well, what do? You pray, because mm-hmm. there's one person that can handle it and it's not us.
Yeah.
And so from there, it just kept getting crazier. So he started taking to everything that they were doing. Mm-hmm. But for the first 72 hours of his life, he's on this cooling pad. And the doctors had said there's a very little chance. First of all, the first critical point was make it through the night.
Yeah.
If he can make it 12 hours, that tells us that he's probably going to be okay up to warming. And they said once they start warming him, they don't know what had happened because of all the severe damage to his kidneys and all of his organs. Once they start warming him up, that starts making those organs work again. Mm-hmm. And when they start working, if they're too damaged, they might not be good. And so they said once he makes it through warming, that's another critical phase. And then we can start doing tests and MRIs to see what was damaged. Mm-hmm. So it's like, look, we've got to sit here 72 hours wondering if our baby's going to make it before we can even start scanning to know what happened.
Right.
And so we went through those 72 hours and we can talk about the little tidbits of the study and stuff during that after we finished the story. But those 72 hours went by and we started the warming and he made it through the warming, which was something we were iffy on whether it was going to happen. And then I was telling her yesterday, I started looking through timing and stuff. And so the first MRI after warming, he warmed up on a Saturday night and they said, we'll do the test Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. The first test he went to do was his MRI and it happened at 10:30 on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And I had told her, I was like, look, God's just telling us, hey, go ahead and do this test while my people are gathered.
Yeah.
And it just was one of those things. It's like his timing of everything just lines out mm-hmm. beautifully. So we went through the test Sunday, got his MRI and his EEG, and they said the neurologist will review these and come talk to us. And they said, with it being like Sunday afternoon at this point, they said it'll probably be Monday when they come. Mm-hmm. So Monday morning comes around. I had went home to take care of something. I think we were getting a door replaced or something. And it was one of those like, are you okay if I leave you for a couple hours while I'll go home and shower and gather more clothes and walk the dog? No, the dog was with my parents. So, but I was like, I'll go home and do all this. And then once they're done with the door, I'll come back. And her mom was with her. And the door people walked in. They walked in, measured the door, and they're like, the door we have's wrong. We have the wrong size door. And this is like a custom ordered door. Uh-huh. So they're like, we can't put the door in today. And I was like, well, that's okay. I was like, and I told the door person, I said, if that's the worst news I get today, we're fine.
And we're good. Yeah.
And so they packed up and left. They were there 30 minutes, which should have been like a half a day job.
Yeah.
And then right after they left, she called me and said, hey, the doctor is a different doctor on shift. Come in to talk to us about what they saw on the results from yesterday's test before the neurologist gets here. They wanted me to call. Mm-hmm. She said that doctor was very blunt, but very negative. And she said, look, I'm going to be honest, based on these results from the MRI and the EEG, there's not much brain function. He's not brain dead, but his body's just not recovering. Mm-hmm. And you may want to start thinking about DNRs and what you're going to do. She said, there's basically three options. We can keep him on this life supporting equipment as long as we can. Mm-hmm. We can take him off and just let him pass on his own, or we can like see. It was like a third option that was kind of similar. It was just, we can put him on like comfort care. Mm-hmm. And we were like, wait, and she's like, and just keep him, like, start thinking, because this decision may be coming soon. And I'm at home on a speakerphone. She's at the hospital. And that's one of those just instances that just slaps you in the face. And you're like, wait, I knew. And they've been telling us this is grim the whole time. But when they actually say stuff like that, it's just
like made it feel more real.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
That was the breakdown point.
Because at this point, he had no gag reflex. He had not opened his eyes. Yeah.
He had warmed up at that point, too. And so when they warmed up, they expected him to start doing these things, and he wasn't.
Yeah. So it was, I mean, just laying there, what you see your baby, and he's just like still not moving. His color was off. Like, it's just really wild to think back, like, how bad of a situation it really was, mm-hmm. and then to see everything as it is now. But yeah, thinking back on it, it's like, okay, that was a little traumatic for sure.
Yeah. So after that phone call, the doctor walked out of the room and all she said was, "Get here." And I said, "I'm on my way." And I literally went and got in the truck, grabbed our stuff, and I text your uncle. And this is the only text I sent besides to my mother. I called my mom on the way to the hospital. Mm-hmm. I text your uncle and said, "We just got some bad news. Pray, pray, pray." That's literally, I looked at the message last night. That's all I said. And then I called my mom and turned my phone off, and I didn't talk to anybody the rest of that day. And but God.
And that was the first day we got to hold him.
Yes, because they didn't.
We got to hold him the day before. We got to hold him on Sunday. Okay. Yeah. Because we couldn't take him out while he was on the cooling bed. And so for the first 3 days, literally, like, we could touch him, but we couldn't hold him. We couldn't, you know, any of the things that a mom yearns to do after she's had her newborn baby.
Yeah.
So I think we spent most of Monday with him out of the crib, just holding him, because we were like, this might be it.
Yeah. And our nurse was phenomenal. And she was like, look, as soon as that doctor walked out, she's like, let's get him out. Like, you need to be holding him. Mm-hmm. And so we went all day just not, I don't even know if we spoke 5 words to each other. We just sat there holding the baby. And little known to us, because like I said, I turned my phone off, wasn't looking.
Yeah.
Your family's insane.
They are.
They had put, just from my one little text to your uncle, had put a whole church-wide night of prayer together within a couple hours. And the church met at 6 o'clock that night to pray, not knowing what they were praying for, just to pray, knowing that we were in a dire situation. That day, we waited all day for the neurologist to show up. They were like, yeah, they should be here. They should be here. Waited. The night of prayer started at 6 o'clock. At 6:15, the neurologist walks through the door. And Ollie's moving. He's responding. The neurologist said, look, this isn't as dire as we thought, because she said, based on the test I've looked at, she said, I walked in here expecting to see a baby laying there and not do anything. But his responses, he had like responses to his pupils. He wasn't opening his eyes, but she opened them, and he squeezed her finger. His toes curled, like those little responses that she wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
She said, let's not worry about these decisions right now. Let's go. There was like a weird time period where they couldn't do tests because the way babies' brains develop is like would give false results. Mm-hmm. So she said, we have to wait until like 9 or 10 days before we can do another round of tests. But let's wait that out. Let's see what those tests show to see if there's anything coming together. And I'd looking through my notes on everything, I took just journaled the whole time we were in the NICU. And the one thing I kept putting was, it's the little victories.
Yeah.
It's like, we may not have a baby that's going to live a so-called normal life. Mm-hmm. He might have, but his toes are wiggling.
Yeah.
His fingers are wiggling. And it was those little victories that got us day by day. And then throughout the time between then and the next test, like, more started happening. He started filling diapers that he wasn't doing before. And he was opening his eyes and doing little things. Then the next round of tests came through, and it showed still severe brain damage, but they had decided by those that what had happened was he had a stroke while he was in utero. Yeah. So not even before labor had started.
Yeah.
He had had a stroke, and that's what, and it severely impacted the back left of his brain, which controlled motor and speech development. Mm-hmm. I think's what they had said. And so they said, so after that second round of tests, they said, we think based on how the rest of his organs came back, because they can heal themselves somehow, they said, he's going to be okay. We may be in here a while, but we'll make it through. But what we don't know is, will he be able to eat on his own? Will he be able to breathe on his own? Because the brain controls all that. So they said, we won't know the extent of the brain until his brain's developed.
Yeah.
And so as that, we just kept praying, like, Lord, give us a little bit. We now know we can probably take a baby home.
Yeah.
But does that mean he's going to be on a ventilator the rest of his life? Is he going to be on a feeding tube?
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, the day came that they were like, look, he's breathing over the vent good enough to where I think we're going to remove the vent and put him on just like an oxygen nasal mm-hmm. piece. And he took to that good. And at that point, that was the day that I think it just, I felt like a dad, because when they took the vent out, he could finally cry.
Yeah.
Like you could, before that, you could see his face like he was crying, mm-hmm. but with the vent, the vent was going past his vocal mm-hmm. cords. So he couldn't cry. Mm-hmm. So when they pulled that vent out and he started crying, I lost it. I'm like, and I never thought I'd be happy to hear a baby cry.
Yeah.
I was like, that's the most beautiful sound I've ever heard. And then it was, well, we've weaned the oxygen down enough. Now we can try feeding. He had been feeding through a tube. So now it was, let's see if he'll take a bottle. Let's see if he'll latch. And he did. It was like every time something like that come, like a milestone came, he shocked everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the milestone, can he breathe? He's like, yeah, I can breathe.
Yeah.
Will he latch? And they said a lot of these babies like this, they just won't take to a bottle, or they can't breathe, suck, and swallow. And so he ate. And at that point, then they started weaning him off. And then it was like a Monday. We knew things were starting to get better. We were starting to look toward an outcome of going home. And the doctor came in and said, look, it's probably going to be 2 or 3 more weeks.
Yeah.
Just based on how he's doing, we're probably going to be monitoring for a couple more weeks before we can take him home. At this point, it had already been 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, okay. And originally, the first doctor had told us, look, if we make it through, you're probably looking 6 to 8 weeks. And we said, okay, that puts us right on the timeline of when the original doctor had said. So we were okay. And then that week, it's like everything just started, I don't know, working. And by Monday, telling us 2 to 3 more weeks, by Friday, they had completely taken him off the nasal cannula. He was breathing on his own, completely eating every meal, no more feeding tube. The mm-hmm. only thing that he was attached to was the like the EKG monitors that every baby in the hospital is attached to.
Yeah.
And Friday come through and the doctor said, well, we think he's doing good. If he can make it through Sunday, you can go home. We're like, we went from 2 to 3 more weeks to, yeah, Sunday, you can go.
Yeah.
And then sure enough, Saturday came and we're like, so we're going home Sunday. We're going home Sunday. And then the doctor come in and the night shift doctor was like, yeah, well, they don't like releasing people on the weekends, so we'll probably make you wait till Monday. And our nurse was like, I don't know why they say that, because we work 24/7. It's not like anybody here that is going to be here Monday that's not here right now. And so then the new doctor shifted on, and she went and talked. Our nurse said, hey, they want to go home. The doctor's like, I don't see any reason not to. All right, go home.
Yeah.
And so it was just literally within 12 hours, it was, we're going home.
That's awesome.
And since then, he's weaned off of all medication. He's started physical therapies and all that. But you would never know, looking at this baby now, that he had such a rough start. And mm-hmm. the one thing that just, the real but God moment
mm-hmm.
was the night before we were leaving. So we knew Sunday morning we're leaving. We're going home. Our night shift nurse was one of our favorites. We still keep in contact with her, but she had said, look, I'm happy, but after I leave, I may never see y'all. I just want you to know how proud the whole staff is.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing she said will stick with me the rest of my life. She said, I've never seen a baby come in so bad
mm-hmm.
and leave without anything. She said, typically if a baby comes in that bad from the start, they have a feeding tube, or they're on oxygen the rest of their life. She said, he's the first one of however many years she had been working that walked out of there with nothing. He's not even on any medication.
Yeah.
And that was like, yeah, well, we serve a mighty God who can do that.
Yeah. That's so crazy.
Yeah.
So how did like the community that you all were around, how did they, I mean, obviously this is probably a long answer, but how did they like help you out and step up to what?
So Ollie was born on July 3rd. Mm-hmm. And so I think the 4th fell, that was a Wednesday. So the 4th fell on a Thursday.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people should have been out celebrating all the things. And we go out to the waiting room. I don't think we knew at this point that anybody was there, and we were passing from the waiting room to go to the NICU, and there's our entire small group, and we're like, what are you guys doing? Like, you have better things you could be doing. It's a holiday. It's warm outside. But they were there in the hospital praying, and I just can't thank them enough for the impact that they had, not just on us, but other people that saw them there.
Yeah.
I think there's a song about turning a waiting room into a sanctuary or something, and they sure did. I mean,
yeah.
And I think of the song Crazy People all the time because they are literally insane.
Yeah.
That day they did that. I mean, they just showed up to pray in the waiting room. Didn't tell us. One couple had texted me and they said, hey, we're going to be in Knoxville. Do you care if we swing by?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, you live in Loudoun. I don't know why you're in Knoxville, but okay. Yeah. So they had came by and had been talking to us and stuff, but we didn't know that literally the rest of the group was out in the waiting room. And so then we just walked by and we were like, oh, hello.
Yeah.
But then also I didn't know the same kind of thing. We didn't know the night that the warming, we had told them that this was a critical process and it was going to go from, it's like, oh, they started at his 72-hour birthday. So they started at 4:21, and it went like 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had told our group, this is what's happening. We like prayer during this time that he starts responding and everything. And we had went home to get more clothes. On our way back, we ran into them. They were leaving to go get something, and we just ran into them, and we were like, what are y'all doing here? And they're like, nothing, and don't go to the waiting room.
Yeah.
They were all there, and they spent 24 hours
rotating taking shifts,
just in the waiting room praying.
Yeah.
And that was a Saturday night, and then they all got up, made it to church on Sunday.
Yeah, that's insane. Just the power of prayer. It's all over that story.
Yeah, it's no kidding. And I think, like, for me, it's been really cool. I've been going here for a while, but our group has kind of morphed and changed over the last couple of years. And so I think that the Experiencing God study was really impactful. And like at the time I had no idea how impactful it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But to be going through that with sisters in Christ and brothers in Christ, and in hindsight, going back and seeing everything the way that it was timed out is just totally mind blowing. I think I could literally write a novel based on our events and how they lined up with what we were studying and experiencing God.
Yeah. His timing there. So we had talked about doing this study 3 or 4 times, and it kept getting postponed. And it was one of those things like this. It'd be random stuff that we're not doing this way. This person wanted to wait, and it was never one of those like, oh yeah, this is why. It was like, why are we postponing this? And nobody really knew. And then we sat down and like, okay, this is the date we started, and we started it. And I was telling one of the guys that is why we were getting postponed, and we didn't know it.
Yeah,
because the week that when Ollie was born, and that first week that all this was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Ever that Monday when we were supposed to do our group meeting, they sent a text and like, hey, let's wait this week. Let's take this week off in a sense and redo this week in the study because of just in case we didn't get it.
Yeah.
And so we waited that week. And so then the week after that was the week. So that during that week, they're showing up, they're doing all this. The next week, the study talks about the church and how you be there for others and you are, the church is the body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, and she had asked me while we're reading it one night, sitting in the NICU, she said, do you think anybody in our group knew that this was what we were going to be talking about this week, last week when they were doing this stuff? They were literally acting out the body of Christ. It's mm-hmm. like, I, no, that was God's timing to say, you're going to wait until this date to start this study. That way you can act this out while you're doing it.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's wild to think yeah. just where he's had his hand on everything. Mm-hmm. You said the power of prayer. And the song that I think of every time is Somebody Prayed by Crowder.
Yeah.
It's just, and that song is to the T. Like, why are we here? It's because somebody prayed.
Yeah. And to hear, like, after, I guess, a couple weeks in, maybe that it had been happening, they announced it, like, at church
yeah.
and told everybody about it. And they were like, they said that he wouldn't last, like, 24 hours. Yeah. And yeah. then here he is 6 months.
Yeah.
And that's insane.
Yeah.
It was, one of the things that I struggled with when we started the Experiencing God was the crisis of belief. I'm like, I have no idea what this means. That's yeah. over my head, all the things. And so somewhere in my notes, one of the things that stuck out was when you face confusing circumstances, don't blame God. Don't give up following him. Go to God. Ask him to reveal the truth of your circumstances. Ask him to show you his perspective, then wait on the Lord. And so one of the things that I tell everybody when I talk about Ollie's story is in that moment when they told me he may or may not make it, all I knew was to trust God. And that's yeah. not most people, and including myself, like I've been in situations before where I'm like, yeah, I don't know, God, what you're doing here. But at that time, all I knew was trust God. Mm-hmm. And so to go back and look at just some of the different things, like this one was from the day after he was born. Mm-hmm. And it says, when God purposes to do something through you, the assignment will have God-sized dimensions. This is because God wants to reveal himself to you and those around you. If you can do the work in your own strength, people will only encounter you, not God. However, if God works through you to do only what he can do, you and those around you will come to experience him. And so one of the things that I've really struggled with is overcomplicating it. And I'm like, yeah. I don't know why he's put me in this situation.
Yeah.
And so it is as simple as God was to be glorified through it. And I didn't know that. I didn't think that I had the words to speak, the words to say what was going on. But I go back and read some of the things that I put together after I had time to process. And I'm like, okay, wait, holy moly. Like, that's actually kind of good.
Yeah.
Just kind of.
It's mind blowing.
It's wild. And yeah. so I have been going back through the Experiencing God, just looking through at different things. And even still, it's like in the middle of being in the NICU when we had nothing better to do than sit around and do a Bible study, the days that certain things came up, it was just like, okay, God, I see you. I yeah. hear you. I'm here. I'm yours. It was yeah. like that moment of full surrender. And it's like, I never would have maybe thought that I'd be at that point before, because I've been through some traumatic things in my life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really, truly have. I told one of the doctors, and it's still kind of a joke to this day, that Kyle had not experienced any trauma in his life until he met me.
Oh my gosh.
Which is, it's really so true.
The doctor did not know what to think about, and he just kind of laughed. He's like,
He's like, oh, this is not going to be good then.
Yeah. So, but just to see, like, how that was preparing me for something so mm-hmm. big, to have that peace knowing that God has it in control, whether or not I take home this baby.
Yeah.
It's not my plan, but his.
Yeah. That's so powerful. And I think, like, from your guys' perspective and from the perspective of people around you, like, just being in the Word was so important for you guys, but then also, like, those people could then encourage you because they had that, like the study that you all were doing yeah. together, because you guys all went through mm-hmm. that, then it was able to like be there when you needed it.
Yeah. And I think one thing that still impacts me now is like hearing people say, oh, thank you for sharing your faith, or oh, thank you for being faithful through this. And mm-hmm. it wasn't a choice at that time, but like I do realize I could have turned my back on God and just been like, what yeah. are you doing? This is not how things were supposed to be. So it's encouraging for me, someone that maybe doesn't think that I'm good enough to be an example for people or whatever. Mm-hmm. Just to hear, like, because I was committed to my faith in that moment, in that time, other people saw God through that. And that's a big deal.
That is a big deal.
I think in the study that talks about the crisis of belief, like you said, I don't know the exact words it uses, but it says the crisis of belief is that point in your life where you have to make the decision. Right now, I have no option. Do I follow God? Do I trust in Him? Or do I turn my back and go the other way? Mm-hmm. And until you sat in that situation, you're like, oh yeah, it's that makes sense. But then when you're actually living it, mm-hmm. and you have that point of, well, God, I don't know what else to do. There's nothing I can do. The doctor said there's nothing he can do, which, what?
Yeah.
That's your job. What do you mean there's nothing you can do? When you're at that point and all you know to do is trust God and pray, that is the mountain mover.
Yeah, it really is. That's, and like you said about, you were talking about one quote that you had either written down or was in the study that, like, it couldn't be on your own strength.
Yeah.
And you both could obviously see that, like, you had no control over it at all.
Yeah. And one thing that I looked back at is, like, I was praying to be a good mom. Had no idea, like, what I was really asking at that point.
Yeah.
But then another thing that stood out is, if you can't be faithful in a little, God will not give you a larger assignment. And so one of the things that I was praying on was, like, okay, what, like, how do I need to change my character to align with your will? Mm-hmm. If you want to do a God-sized thing through me, like, what do I need to do to get to that point? I didn't know what I was asking him, what I was.
Be careful what you ask for.
Yeah. And so then another thing that said, if God has a great task for you, he will expand your character to match that assignment. And so actively, I had no idea, but he was actively molding my character to go through a situation and be able to trust in him and know that ultimately, whatever it is, his plans are so much greater. And I think I keep going back to that because we had all these plans for Ollie. Like, Ollie's going to play drums like his dad, or he's going to play baseball, or he's going to be a golfer. Well, you know, those things may not happen, and that's okay because that was our plan.
Yeah.
And
we had already bought tickets and booked a trip to Colorado for when he was 3 months old.
Yeah.
And we're sitting in the NICU thinking, like, I guess we're not going there. I'll
be able to take that trip.
Yeah. That's so awesome. I love that. Thank you guys so much for sharing your story.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having us.
It's so powerful. And I hope that a lot of people are encouraged by that today. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next week for another episode.